This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Wrong Side of Goodbye, written by Michael Connelly, read by Titus Welliver. For Vin Scully, with many thanks. They charge from the cover of the elephant grass toward the LZ, five of them swarming the slick on both sides, one among them yelling, "Go, go, go!" as if each man needed to be prodded and reminded that these were the most dangerous seconds of their lives. The rotor wash bent the grass back and blew the marker smoke in all directions. The noise was deafening as the turbine geared up for a heavy liftoff. The door gunners pulled everyone in by their pack straps, and the chopper was quickly in the air again, having alighted no longer than a dragonfly on water. The tree line could be seen through the port side door as the craft rose and started to bank. Then came the muzzle flashes from the banyan trees. Somebody yelled, "Snipers!" as if the door gunner had to be told what he had out there. It was an ambush. Three distinct flashpoints, three snipers. They had waited until the helicopter was up and flying fat, an easy target from 600 feet. The gunner opened up his M60, sending a barrage of fire into the treetops, shredding them with lead. But the sniper rounds kept coming. The slick had no armor plating, a decision made 9,000 miles away to take speed and maneuverability over the burden of weight and protection. One shot hit the turbine cowling, a thock sound reminding one of the helpless men on board of a fouled-off baseball hitting the hood of a car in the parking lot. Then came the snap of glass shattering as the next round tore through the cockpit. It was a million-to-one shot, hitting both the pilot and co-pilot at once. The pilot was killed instantly, and the co-pilot clamped his hands to his neck in an instinctive but helpless move to keep blood inside his body. The helicopter yawed into a clockwise spin and was soon hurtling out of control. It spun away from the trees and across the rice paddies. The men in the back started to yell helplessly. The man who had just had a memory of baseball tried to orient himself. The world outside the slick was spinning. He kept his eyes on a single word imprinted on the metal wall separating the cockpit from the cargo hold. It said, "Advance," the letter, A, with a crossbar that was an arrow pointed forward. He didn't move his eyes from the word even as the screaming intensified, and he could feel the craft losing altitude. 7 months backing recon, and now on short time. He knew he wasn't going to make it back. This was the end. The last thing he heard was someone yell, "Brace! Brace! Brace!" as if there was a possibility that anybody on board had a shot at surviving the impact, never mind the fire that would come after, and never mind the Viet Cong, who would come through with machetes after that. While the others screamed in panic, he whispered a name to himself. Viviana. He knew he would never see her again. Viviana. The helicopter dove into one of the rice paddy dikes and exploded into a million metal parts. A moment later, the spilled fuel caught fire and burned through the wreckage, spreading flames across the surface of the paddy water. Black smoke rose into the air, marking the wreckage like an LZ marker. The snipers reloaded and waited for the rescue choppers to come next. Chapter 1. Bosch didn't mind the wait. The view was spectacular. He didn't bother with the waiting room couch. Instead, he stood with his face a foot from the glass and took in the view that ranged from the rooftops of downtown to the Pacific Ocean. He was 59 floors up in the U.S. Bank Tower, and Creighton was making him wait, because it was something he always did, going all the way back to his days at Parker Center, where the waiting room only had a low-angle view of the back of City Hall. Creighton had moved a mere 5 blocks west since his days with the Los Angeles Police Department, but he certainly had risen far beyond that to the lofty heights of the city's financial gods. Still, view or no view, Bosch didn't know why anyone would keep offices in the tower the tallest building west of the Mississippi. It had previously been the target of two foiled terrorist plots. Bosch imagined there had to be a general uneasiness added to the pressures of work for every soul who entered its glass doors each morning. Relief might soon come in the form of the Wilshire Grand Center, a glass-sheathed spire rising to the sky a few blocks away. When finished, it would take the distinction of tallest building west of the Mississippi. It would probably take the target as well. Bosch loved any opportunity to see his city from up high. When he was a young detective, he would often take extra shifts as spotter in one of the department's airships, just to take a ride above Los Angeles and be reminded of its seemingly infinite vastness. He looked down at the 110 freeway and saw it was backed up all the way down through South Central. He also noted the number of helipads on the tops of the buildings below him. The helicopter had become the commuter vessel of the elite. He had heard that even some of the higher contract basketball players on the Lakers and Clippers took helos to work at the Staples Center. The glass was thick enough to keep out any sound. The city below was silent. The only thing Bosch heard was the receptionist behind him answering the phone with the same greeting over and over. "Trident Security, how can I help you?" Bosch's eye held on a fast-moving patrol car going south on Figueroa toward the L.A. Live district. He saw the 01 painted large on the trunk and knew that the car was from Central Division. Soon it was followed in the air by an LAPD airship that moved at a lower altitude than the floor he stood on. Bosch was tracking it when he was pulled away by a voice from behind. "Mr. Bosch?" He turned to see a woman standing in the middle of the waiting room. She wasn't the receptionist. "I'm Gloria." "We spoke on the phone," she said. "Right." "Yes," Bosch said. "Mr. Creighton's assistant." "Yes. Nice to meet you. You can come back now."
"Good. Any longer and I was going to jump."
She didn't smile. She led Bosch through a door into a hallway with framed watercolors perfectly spaced on the walls. "It's impact-resistant glass," she said. "It can take the force of a Category 5 hurricane."
"Good to know," Bosch said. "And I was only joking.
Your boss had a history of keeping people waiting, back when he was deputy chief with the police department."
"Oh, really?
I haven't noticed it here." This made no sense to Bosch, since she had just fetched him from the waiting room 15 minutes after the appointed meeting time. "He must have read it in a management book back when he was climbing the ranks," Bosch said. "You know, keep them waiting, even if they're on time. Gives you the upper hand when you finally bring them into the room. Lets them know you are a busy man."
"I'm not familiar with that business philosophy."
"Probably more of a cop philosophy." They entered an office suite. In the outer office, there were two separate desk arrangements, one occupied by a man in his 20s wearing a suit, and the other empty, and he assumed belonging to Gloria. They walked between the desks to a door, and Gloria opened it and then stepped to the side.
"Go on in," she said. "Can I bring you a bottle of water?"
"No, thanks," Bosch said. "I'm fine."
Bosch entered an even larger room, with a desk area to the left and an informal seating area to the right, where a couple of couches faced each other across a glass-topped coffee table. Creighton was sitting behind his desk, indicating Bosch's appointment was going to be formal. It had been more than a decade since Bosch had seen Creighton in person. He could not remember the occasion, but assumed it was a squad meeting, where Creighton had come in and made an announcement concerning the overtime budget or the department's travel protocols. Back then, Creighton was the head bean counter, in charge of budgeting for the department among his other management duties. He was known for instituting strict policies on overtime that required detailed explanations to be written on green slips that were subject to supervisor approval. Since that approval or disapproval usually came after the extra hours were already worked, the new system was viewed as an effort to dissuade cops from working overtime, or worse yet, get them to work overtime and then deny authorization or replace it with comp time. It was during this posting that Creighton became universally known as Creighton by the rank and file. Though Creighton left the department for the private sector not long after that, the greenies were still in use. The mark he left on the department had not been a daring rescue, or a gun battle, or the takedown of an apex predator.
It had been the green overtime slip.
Harry, come in, Creighton said. Sit down.
Bosch moved to the desk. Creighton was a few years older than Harry, but in good shape. He stood behind the desk with his hand held forward. He wore a gray suit that was tailor-cut to his taut frame. He looked like money. Bosch shook his hand and then sat down in front of the desk. He hadn't gotten dressed up for the appointment. He was in blue jeans, a blue denim shirt, and a charcoal corduroy jacket he had had for at least 12 years. These days, Bosch's work suits from his days with the department were wrapped in plastic. He didn't want to pull one of them out just for a meeting with Creighton.
Chief, how are you? He said.
It's not Chief anymore, Creighton said with a laugh. Those days are long ago.
Call me John.
John, then.
Sorry to keep you waiting out there. I had a client on the phone, and, well, the client always comes first. Am I right?
Sure. No problem. I enjoyed the view.
The view through the window behind Creighton was in the opposite direction, stretching northeasterly across the Civic Center and to the snow-capped mountains in San Bernardino. But Bosch guessed that the mountains weren't the reason Creighton picked this office. It was the Civic Center. From his desk, Creighton looked down on the spire of City Hall, the Police Administration Building, and the Los Angeles Times Building. Creighton was above them all.
It is truly spectacular seeing the world from this angle, Creighton said.
Bosch nodded and got down to business.
So, he said, what can I do for you?
John?
Well, first of all, I appreciate you coming in without really knowing why I wish to see you. Gloria told me she had a difficult time persuading you to come.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that. But like I told her, if this is about a job, I'm not interested. I've got a job.
I heard San Fernando.
But that's got to be part-time, right?
He said it with a slightly mocking tone, and Bosch remembered a line from a movie he once saw. If you're not a cop, you're little people. It also held that if you worked for a little department, you were still little people.
Keeps me as busy as I want to be, he said.
I also have a private ticket. I pick up stuff from time to time on that.
All referrals, correct? Creighton said.
Bosch looked at him a moment.
Am I supposed to be impressed that you checked me out? He finally said.
I'm not interested in working here. I don't care what the pay is. I don't care what the cases are.
Well, let me just ask you something, Harry, Creighton said. Do you know what we do here?
Bosch looked over Creighton's shoulder and out at the mountains before answering.
I know you are high-level security for those who can afford it, he said.
Exactly, Creighton said.
He held up three fingers on his right hand in what Bosch assumed was supposed to be a trident.
Trident Security, Creighton said, specializing in financial, technological, and personal security.
I started the California branch 10 years ago. We have bases here, in New York, Boston, Chicago, Miami, London, and Frankfurt. We are about to open in Istanbul. We are a very large operation with thousands of clients and even more connections in our fields of expertise.
Good for you, Bosch said.
He had spent about 10 minutes on his laptop reading up on Trident before coming in. The upscale security venture was founded in New York in 1996 by a shipping magnate named Dennis Lawton, who had been abducted and ransomed in the Philippines. Lawton first hired a former NYPD police commissioner to be his front man, and then followed suit in every city where he opened a base, plucking a local chief or high-ranking commander from the local police department to make a media splash and secure the absolute must-have of local police cooperation. The word was that 10 years ago Lawton had tried to hire L.A.'s police chief, but was turned down, and then went to Creighton as a second choice.
I told your assistant I wasn't interested in a job with Trident, Bosch said. She said it wasn't about that.
So why don't you tell me what this is about so we can both get on with our days?
I can assure you, I am not offering you a job with Trident, Creighton said.
To be honest, we must have full cooperation and respect from the LAPD to do what we do and to handle the delicate matters that involve our clients and the police. If we were to bring you in as a Trident associate, there could be a problem.
You're talking about my lawsuit.
Exactly. For most of the past year, Bosch had been in the middle of a protracted lawsuit against the department, where he had worked for more than 30 years. He sued because he believed he had been illegally forced into retirement. The case had drawn ill will toward Bosch from within the ranks. It did not seem to matter that during his time with the badge, he had brought more than 100 murderers to justice. The lawsuit was settled, but the hostility continued from some quarters of the department, mostly the quarter at the top. "So if you brought me into Trident, that would not be good for your relations with the LAPD," Bosch said. "I get that. But you want me for something. What is it?" Creighton nodded. It was time to get down to it. "Do you know the name Whitney Vance?" he asked. Bosch nodded. "Of course I do," he said. "Yes, well, he is a client," Creighton said. "As is his company, Advanced Engineering. Whitney Vance has got to be 80 years old. 85, actually, and..." Creighton opened the top middle drawer of his desk and removed a document. He put it on the desk between them. Bosch could see it was a printed check with an attached stub. He wasn't wearing his glasses and was unable to read the amount or the other details. "He wants to speak to you," Creighton finished. "About what?" Bosch asked. "I don't know. He said it was a private matter and he specifically asked for you by name. He said he would discuss the matter only with you. He had this certified check drawn for $10,000. It is yours to keep for meeting him, whether or not the appointment leads to further work." Bosch didn't know what to say. At the moment, he was flush because of the lawsuit settlement, but he had put most of the money into long-term investment accounts, designed to carry him comfortably into old age, with a solid stake left over for his daughter. But at the moment, she had 2+ years of college, and then graduate school tuition ahead of her. She had some generous scholarships, but he was still on the hook for the rest of it in the short term. There was no doubt in his mind that $10,000 could be put to good use. "When and where is this appointment going to be?" he finally said. "Tomorrow morning at 9 at Mr. Vance's home in Pasadena," Creighton said. "The address is on the check receipt. You might want to dress a little nicer than that." Bosch ignored the sartorial jab. From an inside jacket pocket, he took out his eyeglasses. He put them on as he reached across the desk and took the check. It was made out to his full name, Hieronymus Bosch. There was a perforated line running across the bottom of the check. Below it were the address and appointment time, as well as the admonition: "Don't bring a firearm." Bosch folded the check along the perforation and looked at Creighton as he put it into his jacket. "I'm going to go to the bank from here," he said. "I'll deposit this, and if there is no problem, I'll be there tomorrow." Creighton smirked. "There will not be a problem." Bosch nodded. "I guess that's it then," he said. He stood up to go. "There is one more thing, Bosch," Creighton said. Bosch noted that he had dropped from first name to last name status with Creighton inside of 10 minutes. "What's that?" he asked. "I have no idea what the old man is going to ask you, but I'm very protective of him," Creighton said. "He is more than a client, and I don't want to see him taken for a ride at this point in his life. Whatever the task is that he wants you to perform, I need to be in the loop." "A ride?" "Unless I missed something, you called me, Creighton. If anybody's being taken for a ride, it will be me. It doesn't matter how much he's paying me." "I can assure you that's not the case. The only ride is the ride out to Pasadena, for which you just received $10,000. Bosch nodded. "Good," he said. "I'm going to hold you to that. I'll see the old man tomorrow and find out what this is about. But if he becomes my client, then that business, whatever it is, will be between him and me. There won't be any loop that includes you unless Vance tells me there is. That's how I work, no matter who the client is." Bosch turned toward the door. When he got there, he looked back at Creighton. "Thanks for the view." He left and closed the door behind him. On the way out, he stopped at the receptionist's desk and got his parking receipt validated. He wanted to be sure Creighton ate the $20 for that, as well as the car wash he agreed to when he valeted the car. Chapter 2. The Vance estate was on San Rafael, near the Annandale Golf Club. It was a neighborhood of old money, homes and estates that had been passed down through generations and guarded behind stone walls and black iron fences. It was a far cry from the Hollywood Hills, where the new money went and the rich left their trash cans out on the street all week. There were no for sale signs here. You had to know somebody, maybe even share their blood to buy in.
Bosch parked against the curb about 100 yards from the gate that guarded the entrance to the Vance estate. Atop it were spikes, ornately disguised as flowers. For a few moments he studied the curve of the driveway, beyond the gate as it wound and rose into the cleft of two rolling green hills and then disappeared. There was no sign of any structure, not even a garage. All of that would be well back from the street, buffered by geography, iron, and security. But Bosch knew that Whitney Vance, 85 years old, was up there somewhere beyond those money-colored hills, waiting for him with something on his mind. Something that required a man from the other side of the spiked gate. Bosch was 20 minutes early for the appointment and decided to use the time to review several stories he had found on the internet and downloaded to his laptop that morning. The general contours of Whitney Vance's life were known to Bosch, as they were most likely known to most Californians. But he still found the details fascinating and even admirable in that Vance was a rare recipient of a rich inheritance who had turned it into something even bigger. He was the fourth-generation Pasadena scion of a mining family that extended all the way back to the California Gold Rush. Prospecting was what drew Vance's great-grandfather west, but not what the family fortune was founded on. Frustrated by the hunt for gold, the great-grandfather established the state's first strip mining operation, extracting multi-tons of iron ore out of the earth in San Bernardino County. Vance's grandfather followed up with a second strip mine farther south in Imperial County, and his father parlayed that success into a steel mill and fabrication plant that helped support the dawning aviation industry. At the time, the face of that industry belonged to Howard Hughes, and he counted Nelson Vance as first a contractor and then a partner in many different aviation endeavors. Hughes would become godfather to Nelson Vance's only child. Whitney Vance was born in 1931, and as a young man apparently set out to blaze a unique path for himself. He initially went off to the University of Southern California to study filmmaking, but he eventually dropped out and came back to the family fold, transferring to the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, the school Uncle Howard had attended. It was Hughes who urged young Whitney to study aeronautical engineering at Caltech. As with the elders of his family, when it was his turn, Vance pushed the family business in new and increasingly successful directions, always with a connection to the family's original product, steel. He won numerous government contracts to manufacture aircraft parts and founded Advanced Engineering, which held the patents on many of them. Couplings that were used for the safe fueling of aircraft were perfected in the family steel mill and were still used today at every airport in the world. Ferrite extracted from the iron ore at Vance mining operations was used in the earliest efforts to build aircraft that avoided radar detection. These processes were meticulously patented and protected by Vance, and they guaranteed his company's participation in the decades-long development of stealth technologies. Vance and his company were part of the so-called military-industrial complex, and the Vietnam War saw their value grow exponentially. Every mission in or out of that country over the entire length of the war involved equipment from Advanced Engineering. Bosch remembered seeing the company logo, an A, with an arrow through the middle of it, imprinted on the steel walls of every helicopter he had ever flown on in Vietnam. Bosch was startled by a sharp rap on the window beside him. He looked up to see a uniformed Pasadena patrol officer, and in the rear view he saw the black and white parked behind him. He had become so engrossed in his reading that he had not even heard the cop car come up on him. He had to turn on the Cherokee's engine to lower the window. Bosch knew what this was about. A 22-year-old vehicle in need of paint parked outside the estate of a family that helped build the state of California constituted a suspicious activity. It didn't matter that the car was freshly cleaned or that he was wearing a crisp suit and tie rescued from a plastic storage bag. It had taken less than 15 minutes for the police to respond to his intrusion into the neighborhood. "I know how this looks, officer," he began. "But I have an appointment across the street in about 5 minutes, and I was just..." "That's wonderful," the cop said. "Do you mind stepping out of the car?" Bosch looked at him for a moment.
He saw the nameplate above his breast pocket said Cooper.
You're kidding, right? He asked.
No, sir, I'm not, Cooper said. Please step out of the car.
Bosch took a deep breath, opened the door, and did as he was told.
He raised his hands to shoulder height and said, I'm a police officer. Cooper immediately tensed, as Bosch knew he would.
I'm unarmed, Bosch said quickly. My weapon's in the glove box.
At that moment, he was thankful for the edict typed on the check stub telling him to come to the Vance appointment unarmed.
Let me see some ID, Cooper demanded.
Bosch carefully reached into an inside pocket in his suit coat and pulled his badge case.
Cooper studied the detective's badge and then the ID.
It says you're a reserve officer, he said.
Yep, Bosch said. Part-timer.
About 15 miles off your reservation, aren't you?
What are you doing here, Detective Bosch?
He handed the badge case back, and Bosch put it away.
Well, I was trying to tell you, he said. I have an appointment, which you are going to make me late for, with Mr. Vance, who I'm guessing you know lives right over there.
Bosch pointed toward the black gate.
Is this appointment police business? Cooper asked.
It's actually none of your business, Bosch replied.
They held each other's cold stares for a long moment, neither man blinking.
Finally, Bosch spoke.
Mr. Vance is waiting for me, he said.
Guy like that? He'll probably ask why I'm late, and he'll probably do something about it.
You got a first name, Cooper?
Cooper blinked.
Yeah. It's fuck you, he said. Have a nice day.
He turned and started back toward the patrol car.
Thank you, officer, Bosch called after him.
Bosch got back into his car and immediately pulled away from the curb. If the old car still had the juice to leave rubber, he would have done so. But the most he could show Cooper, who remained parked at the curb, was a plume of blue smoke from the ancient exhaust pipe. He pulled into the entrance channel at the gate to the Vance estate and drove up to a camera and communication box. Almost immediately he was greeted by a voice.
Yes.
It was male, young, and tiredly arrogant. Bosch leaned out the window and spoke loudly, even though he knew he probably didn't have to.
Harry Bosch to see Mr. Vance, I have an appointment.
After a moment, the gate in front of him started to roll open.
Follow the driveway to the parking apron by the security post, the voice said. Mr. Sloan will meet you there at the metal detector. Leave all weapons and recording devices in the glove compartment of your vehicle.
Got it, Bosch said.
Drive up, the voice said.
The gate was all the way open now, and Bosch drove through. He followed the cobblestone driveway through a finely manicured set of emerald hills until he came to a second fence line and a guard shack. The double fencing security measures here were similar to those employed at most prisons Bosch had visited, of course with the opposite intention of keeping people out instead of in. The second gate rolled open, and a uniformed guard stepped out of a booth to signal Bosch through and direct him to the parking apron. As he passed, Bosch waved a hand and noticed the Trident security patch on the shoulder of the guard's navy blue uniform. After parking, Bosch was instructed to place his keys, phone, watch, and belt in a plastic tub, and then to walk through an airport-style metal detector, while two more Trident men watched. They returned everything but the phone, which they explained would be placed in the glove box of his car.
Anybody else get the irony here? He asked as he put his belt back through the loops of his pants.
You know, the family made their money on metal.
Now you have to go through a metal detector to get inside the house.
Neither of the guards said anything.
Okay, I guess it's just me then, Bosch said.
Once he buckled his belt, he was passed off to the next level of security. A man in a suit with the requisite earbud and wrist mic and dead-eyed Secret Service stare to go with him. His head was shaved, just so he could complete the tough guy look. He did not say his name, but Bosch assumed he was the Sloan mentioned on the intercom earlier. He escorted Bosch wordlessly through the delivery entrance of a massive gray stone mansion that Bosch guessed would rival anything the DuPonts or Vanderbilts had to offer. According to Wikipedia, he was calling on $6 billion. Bosch had no doubt as he entered that this would be the closest to American royalty he would ever get. He was led to a room paneled in dark wood with dozens of framed 8x10 photographs hung in four rows across one wall. There were a couple of couches and a bar at the end of the room. The escort in the suit pointed Bosch to one of the couches.
Sir, have a seat, and Mr. Vance's secretary will come for you when he's ready to see you.
Bosch took a seat on the couch facing the wall of photos.
Would you like some water? The suit asked.
No, I'm fine, Bosch said.
The suit took a position next to the door they had entered through, and clasped one wrist with the other hand in a posture that said he was alert and ready for anything.
Bosch used the waiting time to study the photographs. They offered a record of Whitney Vance's life and the people he had met over the course of it. The first photo depicted Howard Hughes and a young teenager he assumed was Vance. They were leaning against the unpainted metal skin of a plane. From there, the photos appeared to run left to right in chronological order. They depicted Vance with numerous well-known figures of industry, politics, and the media.
Bosch couldn't put a name to every person Vance posed with, but from Lyndon Johnson to Larry King, he knew who most of them were. In all the photos, Vance displayed the same half-smile, the corner of his mouth on the left side curled up, as if to communicate to the camera lens that it wasn't his idea to pose for a picture. The face grew older, photo to photo, the eyelids more hooded, but the smile was always the same. There were two photos of Vance with Larry King, the longtime interviewer of celebrities and newsmakers on CNN. In the first, Vance and King were seated across from each other in the studio recognizable as King's set for more than two decades. There was a book standing upright on the desk between them. In the second photo, Vance was using a gold pen to autograph the book for King. Bosch got up and went to the wall to look more closely at the photos. He put on his glasses and leaned in close to the first photo so he could read the title of the book Vance was promoting on the show. Stealth, The Making of the Disappearing Plane, by Whitney P. Vance. The title jogged loose a memory, and Bosch recalled something about Whitney Vance writing a family history that the critics trashed more for what was left out than for what it contained. His father, Nelson Vance, had been a ruthless businessman and controversial political figure in his day. He was said but never proven to be a member of a cabal of wealthy industrialists who were supporters of eugenics, the so-called science of improving the human race through controlled breeding that would eliminate undesirable attributes. After the Nazis employed a similar perverted doctrine to carry out genocide in World War II, people like Nelson Vance hid their beliefs and affiliations. His son's book amounted to little more than a vanity project full of hero worship, with little mention of the negatives. Whitney Vance had become such a recluse in his later life that the book became a reason to bring him out into public light and ask him about things omitted.
Mr. Bosch?
Bosch turned from the photos to a woman standing by the entrance to a hallway on the other side of the room. She looked to be almost 70 years old and had her gray hair in a no-nonsense bun on top of her head.
I'm Mr. Vance's secretary, Ida, she said. He will see you now.
Bosch followed her into the hallway. They walked for a distance that seemed like a city block before going up a short set of stairs to another hallway, this one traversing a wing of the mansion built on a higher slope of the hill.
Sorry to keep you waiting, Ida said.
It's okay, Bosch said. I enjoyed checking out the photos.
A lot of history there.
Yes.
Mr. Vance is looking forward to seeing you.
Great. I've never met a billionaire before. His graceless remark ended the conversation. It was as though his mention of money was entirely crass and uncouth in a mansion built as a monument to money. Finally, they arrived at a set of double doors, and Ida ushered Bosch into Whitney Vance's home office. The man Bosch had come to see was sitting behind a desk, his back to an empty fireplace big enough to take shelter in during a tornado. With the thin hands so white it looked like he was wearing a latex glove, he motioned for Bosch to come forward. Bosch stepped up to the desk, and Vance pointed to the lone leather chair in front of it. He made no effort to shake Bosch's hand. As he sat, Bosch noticed that Vance was in a wheelchair with electric controls extending from the left armrest. He saw the desk was clear of work product, except for a single white piece of paper that was either blank or had its contents face down on the polished dark wood.
Mr. Vance, Bosch said, how are you?
I'm old. That's how I am, Vance said.
I have fought like hell to defeat time, but some things can't be beat. It's hard for a man in my position to accept, but I'm resigned, Mr. Bosch.
He gestured with that bony white hand again, taking in all the room with a sweep.
All of this will soon be meaningless, he said.
Bosch glanced around in case there was something Vance wanted him to see. There was a sitting area to the right with a long white couch and matching chairs. There was an office bar that a host could slip behind if necessary. There were paintings on two walls that were merely splashes of color. Bosch looked back at Vance, and the old man offered the lopsided smile Bosch had seen in the photos in the waiting room, the upward curve on only the left side. Vance couldn't complete a full smile. According to the photos Bosch had seen, he never could. Bosch didn't quite know how to respond to the old man's words about death and meaninglessness. Instead, he just pressed on with an introduction he had thought about repeatedly since meeting with Creighton.
Well, Mr. Vance, I was told you wanted to see me, and you've paid me quite a bit of money to be here. It may not be a lot to you, but it is to me. What can I do for you, sir?
Vance cut the smile and nodded.
A man who gets right to the point, he said. I like that.
He reached to his chair's controls and moved closer to the desk.
I read about you in the newspaper, he said. Last year, I believe. The case with that doctor and the shootout. You seem to me like a man who stands his ground, Mr. Bosch. They put a lot of pressure on you, but you stood up to it. I like that. I need that. There's not a lot of it around anymore.
What do you want me to do? Bosch asked again.
I want you to find someone for me, Vance said. Someone who might never have existed.
Chapter 3. After intriguing Bosch with his request, Vance used a shaky left hand to flip over the piece of paper on his desk and told Bosch he would have to sign it before they discussed anything further.
It is a non-disclosure form, he explained. My lawyer said it is ironclad. Your signature guarantees that you will not reveal the contents of our discussion or your subsequent investigation to anyone but me. Not even an employee of mine, not even someone who says they have come to you on my behalf. Only me, Mr. Bosch. If you sign this document, you answer only to me. You report any findings of your investigation only to me. Do you understand?
Yes, I understand, Bosch said. I have no problem signing it.
Very good, then. I have a pen here.
Vance pushed the document across the desk, then drew a pen from an ornate gold holder on his desk. It was a fountain pen that felt heavy in Bosch's hand, because it was thick and made of what he presumed was real gold. It reminded Bosch of the pen Vance used in the photo to sign the book for Larry King. He quickly scanned the document and then signed it. He put the pen down on top of it and pushed both back across the desk to Vance. The old man placed the document in the desk drawer and closed it. He held the pen up for Bosch to study.
This pen was made with gold my great-grandfather prospected in the Sierra Nevada gold fields in 1852, he said. That was before the competition up there forced him to head south, before he realized that there was more to be made from iron than from gold.
He turned the pen in his hand.
It was passed on from generation to generation, he said. I've had it since I left home for college.
Vance studied the pen as if seeing it for the first time. Bosch said nothing. He wondered if Vance suffered from any sort of diminished mental capacity, and if the old man's desire to have him find somebody who may never have existed was some sort of indication of a failing mind.
Mr. Vance, he asked.
Vance put the pen back into its holder and looked at Bosch.
I have no one to give it to, he said. No one to give any of this to.
It was true. The biographical data Bosch had looked up said Vance was never married and childless. Several of the summaries he had read suggested obliquely that he was homosexual, but there was never confirmation of this. Other biographical extracts suggested that he was simply too driven by his work to keep up a steady relationship, let alone establish a family. There were a few brief romances reported,
primarily with Hollywood starlets of the moment. Possibly dates for the cameras to put off speculation about homosexuality. But for the past 40 years or more, Bosch could find nothing.
"Do you have children, Mr. Bosch?" Vance asked.
"A daughter," Bosch answered.
"Where?"
"In school. Chapman University down in Orange County."
"Good school. Is she a film student?"
"Psychology." Vance leaned back in his chair and looked off into the past.
"I wanted to study film when I was a young man," he said. "Dreams of youth."
He didn't finish his thought. Bosch realized he would have to give the money back. This was all some kind of derangement, and there was no job. He could not take payment from this man, even if it was only an infinitesimal drop from Vance's bucket. Bosch didn't take money from damaged people, no matter how rich they were. Vance broke away from his stare into the abyss of memory and looked at Bosch. He nodded, seeming to know Harry's thoughts, then gripped the armrest of his chair with his left hand and leaned forward.
"I guess I need to tell you what this is about," he said.
Bosch nodded. "That would be good, yes." Vance nodded back and offered the lopsided smile again. He looked down for a moment and then back up at Bosch, his eyes deeply set and shiny behind rimless glasses.
"A long time ago, I made a mistake," he said. "I never corrected it. I never looked back. I now want to find out if I had a child. A child I could give my gold pen to."
Bosch stared at him for a long moment, hoping he might continue. But when he did, he seemed to have picked up another string of memory.
"When I was 18 years old, I wanted nothing to do with my father's business," Vance said. "I was more interested in being the next Orson Welles. I wanted to make films, not airplane parts. I was full of myself, as young men often are at that age."
Bosch thought of himself at 18. His desire to blaze his own path had led him into the tunnels of Vietnam.
"I insisted on film school," Vance said. "I enrolled at USC in 1949.
Bosch nodded. He knew from his prior reading that Vance had spent only a year at USC before changing paths, transferring to Caltech, and furthering the family dynasty. There had been no explanation found in his internet search. Bosch now believed he was going to find out why.
"I met a girl," Vance said. "A Mexican girl, and soon afterward she became pregnant. It was the second worst thing that ever happened to me. The first was telling my father."
Vance grew quiet, his eyes down on the desk in front of him. It wasn't difficult to fill in the blanks, but Bosch needed to hear as much of the story from Vance as he could.
"What happened?" he asked. "He sent people," Vance said. "People to persuade her not to have the child. People who would drive her to Mexico to take care of it."
"Did she go?"
"If she did, it was not with my father's people. She disappeared from my life, and I never saw her again. And I was too much of a coward to go find her. I'd given my father all he needed to control me, the potential embarrassment and disgrace. Even prosecution because of her age. I did what I was told. I transferred to Caltech, and that was the end of it."
Vance nodded as though confirming something for himself.
"It was a different time then, for me and for her."
Vance looked up now and held Bosch's eyes for a long moment before continuing.
"But now I want to know. It's when you reach the end of things that you want to go back."
A few heartbeats went by before he spoke again.
"Can you help me, Mr. Bosch?" he asked.
Bosch nodded. He believed the pain in Vance's eyes was real.
"It was a long time ago, but I can try," Bosch said.
"Do you mind if I ask a few questions and take some notes?"
"Take your notes," Vance said. "But I warn you again that everything about this must remain completely confidential. Lives could be in danger. Every move you make, you must look over your shoulder."
I have no doubt that efforts will be made to find out why I wanted to see you and what you are doing for me. I have a cover story for that, which we can get to later. For now, ask your questions.
Lives could be in danger. Those words ricocheted inside his chest as Bosch took a small notebook from the inside pocket of his suit coat. He pulled out a pen. It was made of plastic, not gold. He'd bought it at a drugstore.
You just said lives could be in danger. Whose lives? Why?
Don't be naive, Mr. Bosch. I am sure you conducted a modicum of research before coming to see me. I have no heirs, at least known heirs. When I die, control of Advanced Engineering will go to a board of directors who will continue to line their pockets with millions while fulfilling government contracts. A valid heir could change all of that. Billions could be at stake. You don't think people and entities would kill for that?
It's been my experience that people will kill for any reason and no reason at all, Bosch said. If I find you have heirs, are you sure you want to possibly make them targets?
I would give them the choice, Vance said. I believe I owe them that, and I would protect them as well as is possible.
What was her name, the girl you got pregnant?
Viviana Duarte.
Bosch wrote it down on his pad.
Do you know her birth date by any chance?
I can't remember it.
She was a student at USC?
No, I met her at the EVK. She worked there.
EVK?
The student cafeteria was called Everybody's Kitchen, EVK for short.
Bosch immediately knew this eliminated the prospect of tracing Viviana Duarte through student records, which were usually very helpful, since most schools kept close track of their alums. It meant the search for the woman would be more difficult, and even more of a long shot.
You said she was Mexican, he said. You mean Latina? Was she a U.S. citizen?
I don't know. I don't think she was. My father...
He didn't finish. Your father what? Bosch asked.
I don't know if it was the truth, but my father said that was her plan, Vance said, to get pregnant so I would have to marry her and she would become a citizen. But my father said a lot of things to me that weren't true, and he believed a lot of things that were out of step, so I don't know.
Bosch thought about what he had read about Nelson Vance and eugenics. He pressed on. By any chance, do you have a photograph of Viviana, he asked.
No, Vance said. You don't know how many times I've wished for a photograph, that I could just look at her one more time.
Where did she live?
By the school, just a few blocks away. She walked to work.
Do you remember the address? The street, maybe?
No, I don't remember. It was so long ago, and I spent so many years trying to block it out. But the truth is, I never really loved anybody again after that.
It was the first time Vance mentioned love or gave an indication of how deep the relationship had been. It had been Bosch's experience that when you looked back at life, you used a magnifying glass. Everything was bigger, amplified. A college tryst could become the love of a lifetime in memory. Still, Vance's pain seemed real so many decades after the events he was describing. Bosch believed him. How long were you together with her before all this happened, he asked.
8 months between the first and last times I ever saw her, Vance said. 8 months.
Do you remember when she told you she was pregnant? I mean, what month or time of year?
It was after the start of the summer session. I had enrolled just because I knew I would see her, so late June 1950, maybe early July.
And you say you met her 8 months before that?
I had started in September the year before. I noticed her right away working at the EVK. I didn't get the courage to talk to her for a couple of months.
The old man looked down at the desk. What else do you remember? Bosch prompted. Did you ever meet her family? Do you remember any names?
No, I didn't, Vance said.
She told me her father was very strict, and they were Catholic, and I was not. You know, we were like Romeo and Juliet. I never met her family, and she never met mine.
Bosch seized on the one piece of information in Vance's answer that might advance the investigation.
Do you know what church she went to?
Vance looked up, his eyes sharp.
She told me she was named after the church where she was baptized, St. Vibiana's.
Bosch nodded. The original St. Vibiana's was in downtown, just a block from the LAPD headquarters where he used to work. More than 100 years old, it was badly damaged in the 1994 earthquake. A new church was built nearby, and the old structure was donated to the city and preserved. Bosch wasn't sure he believed it was an event hall and library now. But the connection to Viviana Duarte was a good one. Catholic churches kept records of births and baptisms. He felt this bit of good information countered the bad news that Viviana had not been a USC student. It was also a strong indication that she might have been a U.S. citizen, whether or not her parents were. If she was a citizen, she would be easier to track through public records.
If the pregnancy was carried a full term, when would the child have been born, he asked.
It was a delicate question, but Bosch needed to narrow the timing down if he was going to wade into records.
I think that she was at least 2 months pregnant when she told me, Vance said. So I would say January of the following year would be the birth, maybe February.
Bosch wrote it down. How old was she when you knew her, he asked.
She was 16 when we met, Vance said. I was 18.
It was another reason for the reaction of Vance's father. Viviana was underage. Getting a 16-year-old pregnant in 1950 could have gotten Whitney into minor but embarrassing legal trouble.
Was she in high school, Bosch asked.
He knew the area around USC. The high school would have been manual arts, another shot at traceable records.
She had dropped out to work, Vance said. The family needed the money.
Did she ever say what her father did for a living, Bosch asked.
I don't recall.
Okay, going back to her birthday, you don't remember the date, but do you remember ever celebrating it with her during those 8 months?
Vance thought a moment, and then shook his head. No, I can't remember a birthday occurring, he said.
And if I have this right, you were together from late October till June and maybe early July, so her birthday would have likely been somewhere in July to late October, roughly. Vance nodded. Narrowing it to 4 months might help at some point when Bosch was going through records. Attaching a birth date to the name Viviana Duarte would be a key starting point. He wrote the spread of months down, and the likely birth year, 1933. He then looked up at Vance.
Do you think your father paid her or her family off, he asked,
so they would keep quiet and just go away?
If he did, he never told me that, Vance said. I was the one who went away, an act of cowardice I have always regretted.
Have you ever looked for her before now? Ever paid anybody else to?
No, sadly I have not. I can't say if anyone else has.
Meaning what?
Meaning that it is quite possible such a search was conducted as a preemptive move in preparation for my death.
Bosch thought about that for a long moment. He then looked at a few notes he had written. He felt he had enough to start.
You said you had a cover story for me?
Yes.
James Franklin Aldridge.
Write it down.
Who is he? My first roommate at USC. He was dismissed from the school in the first semester.
For academics?
No, for something else. Your cover is that I asked you to find my college roommate because I want to make amends for something we both did, but he took the blame for. This way, if you're looking at records from that time, it will seem plausible.
Bosch nodded. It might work. Is it a true story?
It is.
I should probably know what it is you both did.
You don't need to know that to find him.
Bosch waited a moment,
but that was all Vance had to say on the subject. Harry wrote the name down after checking the spelling of Aldridge with Vance and then closed his notebook. Last question. The odds are Viviana Duarte is dead by now, but what if she had the child and I find living heirs? What do you want me to do? Do I make contact?
No. Absolutely not.
You make no contact until you report to me. I'll need thorough confirmation before any approach will be made. DNA confirmation? Vance nodded and studied Bosch for a long moment before once more going to the desk drawer. He removed a padded white envelope with nothing written on it. He slid it across the desk to Bosch.
I am trusting you, Mr. Bosch. I have now given you all you need to trick an old man if you want. I trust you won't.
Bosch picked up the envelope. It wasn't sealed. He looked into it and saw a clear glass test tube containing a swab used to collect saliva. It was Vance's DNA sample.
This is where you could be tricking me, Mr. Vance.
How so? It would have been better if I had swabbed you, collected this myself.
You have my word.
And you have mine. Vance nodded, and there did not seem to be anything else to say. I think I have what I need to start.
Then I have a final question for you, Mr. Bosch.
Go ahead.
I'm curious because it wasn't mentioned in the newspaper stories I read about you. But you appear to be the right age. What was your status during the Vietnam War?
Bosch paused a moment before answering. I was over there, he finally said. Two tours. I probably flew more times on the helicopters you helped build than you ever did. Vance nodded.
Probably so, he said.
Bosch stood up. How do I reach you if I have more questions or want to report what I find out?
Of course.
Vance opened the desk drawer and removed a business card. He handed it to Bosch with a shaking hand. There was a phone number printed on it. Nothing else.
Call that number, and you will get to me. If it's not me, then something is wrong. Don't trust anyone else you speak to.
Bosch looked from the number on the card to Vance, sitting in his wheelchair, his papier-mâché skin and wispy hair looking as frail as dried leaves. He wondered if his caution was paranoia, or if there was a real danger to the information he would be seeking.
Are you in danger, Mr. Vance? He asked. A man in my position is always in danger, Vance said.
Bosch ran his thumb along the crisp edge of the business card. I'll get back to you soon, he said.
We have not discussed payment for your services, Vance said.
You've paid me enough to start. Let's see how it goes.
That payment was only to get you to come here.
Well, it worked, and it's more than enough, Mr. Vance. All right if I find my way out, or will that set off a security alarm?
As soon as you leave this room, they'll know it and come to meet you.
Vance registered Bosch's puzzled look.
This is the only room in the house not under camera surveillance, he explained. There are cameras to watch over me, even in my bedroom. But I insisted on privacy here. As soon as you leave, they will come.
Bosch nodded. I understand, he said. Talk to you soon. He stepped through the door and started down the hallway. Soon enough, Bosch was met by the nameless man in the suit and escorted wordlessly through the house and out to his car. Chapter 4. Working cold cases had made Bosch proficient in time travel. He knew how to go back into the past to find people. Going back to 1951 would be the farthest and likely the most difficult trek he had ever made, but he believed he was up to it, and that made him excited about the challenge. The starting point was finding the birth date of Viviana Duarte, and he believed he knew the best way to accomplish that. Rather than go home after his meeting with Vance, Bosch took the 210 freeway across the northern rim of the valley and headed toward the city of San Fernando. Barely bigger than 2 square miles in size, San Fernando was an island city within the megalopolis of